Migrating to stateful cloud native platforms on AWS EKS migrating stateful workloads to cloud native platforms is not merely a containerization exercise. It is a sequence of isolation, data consistency, and operational automation decisions that determine whether the platform survives production. In this article, I walk through the journey of a financial-grade platform that moved it from manually managed VMs to a multi-tenant EKS environment with Kubernetes operators, managed persistent storage, and end-to-end observability. Stateful multi-tenant cloud-native platforms are the new minefield of infrastructure engineering. When state matters, and in financial systems it always does, Kubernetes elasticity promise collides with the reality of consistency, cross-tenant data isolation, and partial failures that have no simple rollback. I have watched this migration be rushed, with teams treating stateful pods as if they were Lambda functions and paying the price in data corruption incidents and tenant isolation breaches. What I present here is the structured journey I would recommend and have executed for moving a financial platform from legacy VMs to a multi-tenant EKS environment with real guarantees. The starting point, VMs, implicit state, and the illusion of control. The original platform ran on RCZ Poached Large EC2 instances with directly mounted GP2 EBS disks, a per-tenant PostgreSQL database on RDS single AZ, and a manually managed Redis cache layer bootstrapped via shell scripts. The model worked until it didn't. Each tenant had its own instance set, which provided strong isolation but made operational costs prohibitive. Forta tenants meant Forta infrastructure stacks, Forta patch pipelines, 40 failover runbooks. The operations team spent more time managing infrastructure than delivering value. State was implicit everywhere. User sessions in local memory, processing queues in unpartitioned PostgreSQL tables, and tenant configurations scattered across manually versioned .env files. There was no reliable inventory of which instance served which tenant at any given moment. When a node failed, recovery involved SSH, manual log inspection, and EBS snapshot restoration, an average MTTR of 47 minutes for data incidents. Pressure to migrate came from two directions. Cost. The EC2's bill grew linearly with tenant count and compliance. A SOC 2's Type 2 audit identified the lack of auditable logical separation between tenants as a high-risk finding. The decision to move to EKS was not made out of trend chasing. It was made because the Kubernetes operator model offered the lifecycle automation the team needed to scale without proportionally growing the operations headcount. The migration journey, six phases with real decisions. Phase 1, state inventory and workload classification. Before touching any infrastructure, we mapped every state surface. Transactional data, PostgreSQL, session cache, job queues, PG tables, document blobs already on S3s, and tenant configuration local files. Each category received it a classification: stateless, stateful ephemeral, or stateful durable. Stateless workloads migrated first. Stateful durable workloads migrated last and required dedicated operators. Phase 2's EKS multi-tenancy model design. We evaluated three models: cluster per tenant, strong isolation, high cost, namespace per tenant on a shared cluster, cost efficient isolation via RBAC and network policy, and namespace per tenant with dedicated node pools per criticality tier. We chose the third, namespaces per tenant with separate node groups for gold tenants, dedicated RCZ I2s large instances with taints, and silver, bronze shared node group with MCs IPS large. This balanced cost and blast radius isolation. Phase 3 CSI, EFS, and Aurora Serverless V2. for transactional data, we migrated from RDS single AZ to Aurora PostgreSQL serverless vdos with read replicas per tenant group, the EBS CSI driver with a GP3 storage class, 3000 IOPS baseline, 125 megasent throughput replaced manually mounted GPDUS volumes. For artifacts shared across pods within the same tenant reports uploads, we used EFS with per name mentioned access points, enforcing file system isolation without accidental cross-tenant sharing. Phase 4, Kubernetes operators for tenant lifecycle. We developed a custom operator using controller ring that reacted to a tenant workspace CRD. On tenant workspace creation, the operator provisioned a namespace with tenant labels, resource quota, CPO, MSEA, PVC, isolation network policy, a service account with IRSA binding to the tenant's KMS key, and a secret in AWS Secrets Manager referenced via external secrets operator. New tenant provisioning time dropped from 4 hours manual to 8 minutes, automated DELA, phase sync, data migration with controlled cutover window. We used AWS DMS with continuous replication, CDC to synchronize legacy RDS databases with the new Aurora clusters during a 72-hour shadow period. Cutover was executed tenant by tenant, starting with lowest transaction volume. Each cutover followed the pattern. One drained connections from the legacy app. Dos confirmed replication lag, 5 seconds. Três promote Aurora as primary, 4. Update internal DNS via Route 53's weighted routing, 5. Monitor for 30 minutes before decommissioning the legacy instance. Phase 6, observability and SLO validation. We instrumented all services with OpenTelemetry SDK, traces and metrics, exporting to AWS X-Ray traces and CloudWatch container insights, infrastructure metrics. A Datadog dashboard consolidated per tenant SLOs, 99.9% availability 30-day window, P99 latency sees for write operations, and error rate 0.1%. Burn rate alerts were configured to fire when the error budget consumed more than 5% in 1 hour, well before violating the SLO, the isolation model, beyond the namespace. Namespace per tenant is necessary, but far from sufficient in a financial environment. The namespace is a naming and RBAC boundary. It does not prevent a misconfigured pod from accessing another tenant's network, nor does it prevent an encryption key from being inadvertently shared. The isolation model we implemented has 4 layers. 1. Network isolation. A default network policy denies all ingress and egress traffic within the cluster except explicitly permitted routes. Each tenant can only communicate with its own namespace and the platform services namespace, containing the egress proxy and authentication service. We used Calico's the CNI for global network policy support, which applies rules before namespace level policies point dos. Identity isolation. Each tenant service account has a dedicated IAM role via IRSA XContum plum roller and an annotation. The IAM role has a string equals condition on STS. Assume role with web identity that verifies the OIDC token sub, ensuring only pods from the correct namespace can assume that role. This prevents privilege escalation, even if a pod manages to create a service account in another namespace point 3s. Encryption isolation. Each tenant has its own KMS customer managed key, CMK. EBS volumes, secrets, manager secrets, and S3's tenant are encrypted with the tenant's CMK. The CMK key policy uses KSMS via service and auth. Source account conditions to ensure only calls originating from the correct services can use the key point 4. Resource isolation. Per namespace resource quota and limit range prevent a tenant from monopolizing CPU or memory on the shared node group. For gold tenants, taints on dedicated nodes ensure No pod from another tenant is scheduled there, even under scheduling pressure. Kubernetes operators, the difference between real automation and scripts with kubectl. The decision to invest in a custom operator rather than helpless kubectl scripts was the most internally debated. The argument against was legitimate. Operators have high development costs, introduce a critical component into the control plane, and are difficult to debug when the reconciliation loop enters an inconsistent state. The argument in favor, which prevailed, was based on three properties scripts do not have: continuous reconciliation, a script runs once. An operator continuously observes desired state versus actual state. When an engineer accidentally deleted a tenant's network poly in production, it happened. The operator recreated it within 30 seconds before any unauthorized traffic could occur. With the scripts, that would have been a security incident, full lifecycle management. The operator handles creation, update, and deletion, with finalizers to ensure data is not deleted before backup. A provisioning script rarely includes safe deprovisioning logic, and when it does, it is tested with far less rigor. Native status and observability. The tenant workspace's CRD has a tat statuses field with conditions like storage provisioned, network policy applied, secret sync. Any tool consuming the Kubernetes API can observe each tenant's state in real time. This was critical for the support team. Instead of SSHing into nodes, they run kubectl get tenant workspace and platform ops and see every tenant's state in seconds. The real cost of the operator was approximately 3 development sprints and 1 sprint of integration test hardening. Operational break-even was reached in month 4 when the tenant count exceeded 60 and management complexity would have required hiring an additional operations engineer, stateful persistence in Kubernetes. What nobody tells you about PVCs in production: persistent volume claims backed by EBS have a fundamental limitation that frequently surprises migrating teams. An EBS volume can only be mounted on a single node at a time, grided once. This has direct implications for deployment strategies with a deployment not stateful set. A rolling update may attempt to create the new pod on a different node before the old pod releases the volume, resulting in the new pod stuck in container creating indefinitely, waiting for the volume to detach. In financial environments with short maintenance windows, this can be catastrophic. The solution we adopted was threefold. 1. Use stateful set for all EBS-backed PC workloads, which guarantees the old pod is terminated before the new one is created, thus configure pod management policy. Parallel only for stateful sets, where startup order does not matter, Redis cache, keeping ordered ready for those with initialization dependencies. 3. Implement pod disruption budget with min available, 1 to ensure node drains during AKS upgrades. Do not remove the sole pod of a critical tenant without a ready replacement. For the use case of artifacts shared across multiple pods of the same tenant, asynchronously generated reports, for example, EFS with read-write menu was the right choice, but with an important caveat: EFS has significantly higher write latency than EBS for synchronous operations, typically 1.5 mms versus 0.10. 5 MS for GP3s. Any code pass that wrote to EFS synchronously was refactored to asynchronous writes via SQS, with EFS as the final destination after processing. Critical risks that almost cost us the migration. Asked 1. Cross-tenant state leakage via shared cache. In an early version, Redis was shared across silver tenants using key prefixes as separators. A prefix bug in a code release exposed the session data from one tenant to another, for 12 minutes before detection. The fix was moving to Reddit stateful sets per tenant group, not per individual tenant prohibitive cost, with ACL authentication per tenant DOS. EBS volume attachment storm during node group upgrades. During a rolling upgrade of a node group with 3 tenants, all EBS volumes attempted to detach and reattach simultaneously. The 28 volume EBS limit per RC0.2's large instance was hit, causing scheduling failures. The fix was setting max staff hours, one on the node group and using pod disruption budgets to enforce a controlled pod migration pace. 3. Network policy configuration drift. Scris. With the reconciliation operator inactive for 40 minutes during a maintenance window, an emergency manual deploy created a pod without the correct tenant labels, which fell outside the network policies and had unrestricted access to the cluster's internal network. This reinforced the rule: the operator must never be disabled. Even during maintenance, it must be updated with zero downtime via rolling update. Observability in multi-tenant platforms. Tenant as a first-class dimension. The most common mistake I see in multi-tenant platforms is treating observability as an infrastructure concern, CPU, memory, and latency metrics aggregated at the cluster level. This is useless when a customer calls complaining of slowness. You cannot isolate the problem without tenant dimensions. The most impactful architectural decision in the observability phase was defining tenant ID as a mandatory dimension on all platform metrics, traces, and logs. This was implemented in 3 layers: application. The Hotel SDK was configured with a resource that includes tenant ID and tenant tier as attributes. All spans inherited these attributes automatically. On the metrics side, we used exemplars to link high cardinality metrics to specific traces essential for investigating P99 for specific tenant gas. CloudWatch Container Insights was configured with enhanced observability on EKS, collecting per pod metrics with Kubernetes labels. A CloudWatch Logs Insights metric filter extracts tenant ID from structured logs and creates custom metrics with that dimension, per tenant SLOs. In Datadog, each tenant has an independent SLO monitor. The burn rate alert uses a 1-hour window, fast alert, and 6-hour window trend alert. When the 1-hour burn rate exceeds 14, consuming 2% of the budget in 1 hour, a PagerDuty alert is created with tenant ID in the title. The on-call engineer immediately knows which tenant is impacted without investigating dashboards. The ingestion cost of high cardinality metrics was a real concern. The solution was using Histogram Quantile in Prometheus, running as a managed service via AMP for latency metrics rather than per percentile gauges, reducing cardinality by 80% with equivalent precision for SLOs. MicroRetour's note: if I were starting this migration today, the one thing I would do differently is invest in the Kubernetes operator before migrating the first tenant, not after the 5th. The temptation to use Helm charts and bash scripts for the first few tenants is enormous, and the technical debt it creates is disproportionate. The hardest lesson I carry from this journey is that isolation in multi-tenant platforms is not a feature you add later. It is a property that must be mathematically proven before the first production tenant, with namespace, penetration test, and network policy failure simulations. In financial environments, a cross-tenant data leak is not a severity juice, bug, it is a regulatory event. Verdict: stateful cloud-native platforms are viable in financial production with the right conditions. Migrating to a stateful cloud-native multi-tenant platform on EKS is technically feasible and operationally superior to the per-tenant VM model, but only if you accept that the initial investment is larger than it appears. The Kubernetes operator, the four-layer isolation model, and tenant-dimensioned observability are not optional optimizations. They are prerequisites for operating safely at scale. The numbers speak for themselves. 68% cost reduction per tenant, MTR from 47 minutes to 4 minutes, and provisioning from 4 hours to 8 minutes are real results. But they were preceded by 3 months of platform work that delivered no business features. If your organization does not have tolerance for that upfront investment, the per-tenant VM model, expensive as it is safer than a poorly isolated Kubernetes platform. Cloud native is not the right destination for everyone, but for those who do the work properly, the compounding operational advantage over time is hard to argue against.